Jonathan Howcroft, Halftime's Dual International. For the new Mexican chicken sub from Subway.
It's great to have you back on a Wednesday afternoon. One day I'm going to work out those words. I'm going to sing it properly. JP, good to see you, sir.
Good afternoon, Daniel. I think this is another great one for listeners. I think this is the first time that I've seen you in jeans.
Yeah, I wasn't happy about it.
Is it that cold?
No, I ran out of shorts, couldn't find any more. It's one of those awkward situations where there's a pair sitting there on the floor, but I know that they've been worn a few times. They need to be washed. They need to be washed, those shorts. And the other ones are just the athletic type of power, and you can't wear that to work. Well, I probably could. No one cares. But I didn't want to. So I found myself in a quandary. I had to wear pants.
That is a social requirement.
It's not. Just as long as there's coverage of the region, that's all that's required socially.
That's true. And just to throw me even further, the sneaky SMS machine is down.
The sneaky SMS.
How are we going to communicate?
As KB said, has gone down on me, and it's broken. It's broken.
Do you feel like you're just talking to a mirror?
It's a very different environment in here when the SMS machine's not working. But it's actually good.
Yeah.
It's actually good. It's nice to have the sneak peek to the glance at the SMS machine that you would normally sort of resort to every couple of minutes. It's just focus on what you're doing. It's just bang, bang, bang. So you and I, it's just mano a mano here today.
The pressure's on.
Until they start ringing in on 9429-1116 with your topics of the day. And I was hoping you would bring up topic number one. I know you want to talk about the A-League Grand Final, and I know you want to talk about the volatility in the AFL, and I know you want to talk about language use in sporting conversations and phrasings and that type of thing. And Player of the Year voting, and Matty Winley had a crack at that too before.
Good.
But I really wanted you to be the one that I could discuss, digest, analyse this Kevin Peterson situation with, and you've brought it to the table.
Good.
JP.
Good. Well, for everyone that's listening, you should also know that when I sent my notes through, I put a caveat to my email about KP saying, if you're all bored of me talking about KP or the KP situation.
We're not.
That, fine.
But this is Ashes year.
I'm here. Even they're all they Ashes years now.
Even if
Daniel.
They are, the SMS machine doesn't work. So you're
exactly.
Gonna, you're not going to hear them.
No.
You're not going to see that.
So KP.
It's fantastic. It's such good drama. It is such good fodder. Now, I love, as you know, I love cricket. And I think Kevin Peterson, I've really warmed to him over the last 12 months, the way he's conducted himself in Australia.
He has done a very good PR job over
here. He has. He's done a... Yeah. Pull the wool over our eyes. I'm not sure how the situation is. You know him better than I do.
Well, he also... let's also not forget that he wrote a book which completely trashed the dressing room.
So. Yes, yes. It wasn't overly positive towards his fellow team members.
No, not the cheesy ones.
No. He had some issues. We understand that. But that was part of the thing we liked about him. From his point of view, he's honest. And he gave us his account of...
He did.
...of proceedings.
And Ricky Ponting butted him up and spread him over toast quite nicely for 25 minutes during one commentary session.
Oh, was that during the BBL? I missed that. I missed that one.
Oh, it was wonderful.
Was it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, just I missed that one.
Death by a thousand cuts.
Right.
Yeah, very, very good.
From Ricky?
From Ricky. Yeah, very, very good.
Just a little velvet sledgehammer.
Yeah. Oh, excellent. Yeah. He's top draw, Ricky Ponting. Top draw.
Well, I have to find some audio of that.
So what do you think about KP? Do you think England are incorrect to rule him out of selection for the summer?
Yes. Short answer is yes.
Clearly the short answer is yes. It has to be yes. He's just scored an unbeaten 355, the sixth highest score in county championship history. You don't rule a guy out for the summer based on the form that he's currently in. He's England's all-time highest international run scorer.
He's got a lot of things going for him.
There's an awful lot going for him. And this is my issue with the KP situation, more broadly, and particularly the incident that, you know, what's happened over the past 24 hours. It's not about KP anymore. And this is what I want people to try and understand if they think it's, oh, well, he's too old, he didn't play well in the Ashes, he's a destructive personality in the changing room. All of that, it's detail now. They're footnotes to history. The issue is the ECB and their utter incompetence. From top down, from one chairman who talked about Alistair Cook being the right captain because he comes from the right family, to the new chairman who's barely not even started, who indicated to KP that the door was open for him to retire,
yes,
when clearly it wasn't. Then you go.
I'd
down
be annoyed, by the way, if I was told that.
You'd be furious. Which he has come out in the Telegraph in the UK, written a first person article and said exactly that.
Yep.
And then you go down a step, and you've got Paul Downton,
he just got the boot.
Who's got the boot? And Andrew Strauss coming in, who have this, what for me anyway, a warped sense of what their responsibility is to the game. There's a huge disconnect in the UK, in England, for, you know, for want of the England cricket team, between who accesses the game. It's now ring-fenced on pay-per-view TV. So there's a generation now that doesn't watch England on free-to-air. And the last major event...
Is that right?
That's right. And the last major event of free-to-air cricket in England was the 2005 Ashes. And that was a high watermark for...
No doubt.
Blimey, for what's probably since the 81 Botham's Ashes, really, in terms of where cricket registered on Britain's sporting cultural map. And KP is pretty much the last, I guess, star of that 2005 team that people can still associate with. He is unashamedly populist. He has cheerleaders around him. Some of them not always to his advantage, like Piers Morgan, but he has more, you know, more than that. Mm. The ECB is this stuffy, old-fashioned old boys network. And the combination of the two, this brash, populist, just pure cricketer, and this horrible, you know, wood paneled corridors, leaks more than a sieve establishment, which has its priorities completely wrong. For me, just kind of, you know, what we saw over 24 hours was just the perfect reflection of that. What should have been about Andrew Strauss setting his agenda became about KP, because the ECB can't handle making decisions, sticking to those decisions, and communicating effectively.
So what should they have done? Have they made the right call?
Well, you can look at it a number of different ways. The core of it all for me...
Andrew Strauss was captain of England for 46 tests that he played with Kevin Peterson.
Yes.
And there's a lot of dissension between those two, a lot of unrest.
Strauss implied that he should see you next Tuesday during a live commentary when he didn't realise the mic
was still
on.
Which isn't fantastic.
It's not.
Feedback.
It's not.
No.
It's
not. So there's definite war of words between those two, has been for quite some time. So that's a bit of background just to their relationship. Now, he's the general manager of cricket now at the ECB.
Yes.
Right.
So he's
first
the Pat
public
Howard
address.
He's Pat Howard. Of the England team.
Yep, and he had his first address to the media,
and
this was always going to come up because Colin Graves had apparently suggested to Kevin a couple of times on the phone that if he gets himself a county, doesn't play the IPL, gets himself a county, makes some runs, then he will be more than in contention to regain his spot in the England Test soon.
Yes.
And despite that assurance from Colin, as soon as Andrew Strauss gets the position...
Yeah.
This unbelievable leak occurs to the media, saying that, in fact, after that meeting with KP, he won't be playing.
Yes.
Right. So that's just a bit of background on the story.
So to kind of go back to the broader point in terms of what they should have done, I don't think there was a definitive right or wrong answer. But England's performance over the past 18 months, since the start of the previous Ashes in Australia, is just the most poor reflection of everybody involved in England's high performance. So you fast forward 18 months to where we are now, for it still to be about Kevin Peterson indicates that nothing has been learned, that we haven't moved on from whatever the problems were that have caused England's poor performance over this time, which clearly isn't one individual. Mm. Now, you look at it from a pure cricketing standpoint, you've got Gary Ballance, who looks tidy at three, you've got Ian Bell at four, Joe Root, probably England's best player now at five.
Yep.
And then in Moeen Ali, Ben Stokes, Joss Butler, you've got players who will fill six, seven and eight
at
various points during the summer. So Kevin Peterson isn't that critical to England's future success. This is about England not being very good, full stop. And this one individual highlighting all of the other issues that distract the governance and the management at the highest level, rather than actually getting on and doing their job. So
this should have been handled many, many moons ago.
Of course it should. Mm. Yeah, I mean, for a start, he shouldn't have been banned. They should have said, look, we're not picking you, we're dropping you.
Yep.
And then if he goes and writes that book, he burns every bridge, and he loses a lot of the neutral support. for me, I've got no problem with that argument that what he put in that book was enough for him not to play for England again.
Yep.
I think he burnt bridges. He broke dressing room trust so significantly that for me, this isn't, you know, when Andrew Strauss talks about it being a trust between him and the ECB, I actually do agree with him. I think that what Kevin Peterson did, but from the other side, the behaviour of the ECB and the way that they've handled more than just that one situation means that I've got absolutely no faith in their decision-making. I don't think Andrew Strauss is the right appointment. Paul Downson clearly wasn't the right appointment. They've messed Peter Moores around twice now.
Yep.
Alistair Cook shouldn't be captain anymore. You go through this series of decisions that have taken them to this point. This is a country that's probably spent more on their high-performance system than any other country in the world. They're part of the trio that's hijacked the ICC with, you know, under the stewardship of Giles Clark, all of which has got them where? You know, they're a basket case.
Yes, it seems to be the case.
And it still comes down to Kevin Peterson. It makes you scratch, you know, it just hurts your head.
In the broader picture, from an English cricket point of view, how many, and I tried to get to the bottom of this with Hoggy the other day, but I'm not sure we did, how many former elite players, England national players, are involved in the hierarchy and the decision-making in English cricket? But I know that Michael Vaughan and Alex Stewart applied for this new role that Andrew Strauss has mm-hmm. got, the high performance, the Pat Howard role. Would they be likely to hang around and be a part to try and regain some footing on the world scene?
This cuts to the core of the problem with the English game, that you've got 18 counties. Mm. So you've got that volume of stakeholders. You think about when Cricket Australia centralised, it had to negotiate with six states.
Yep.
Triple that for England, and then that amount of dilution of influence. And then there's still a perception that there's a clique, there's the old boys network. So the MCC...
Yep.
The Lords Middlesex kind of connection. So in answer to your question, Michael Vaughan will remain as effectively as an outsider, but he's a significant player manager as well. So
is he? I didn't know that.
Yeah, there's a lot of allegations of conflict of interest when he talks about certain players should be in the England team, for example, because, you know, they're under his stewardship. Alex Stewart's a different one. I think he exists as a bit of an island in this, that his longevity in the game, his dedication to England and Surrey, where he's still a coach, gives him a status. But there are big question marks over him in an international sense, because he will struggle to gain any traction in India, because there are allegations of him providing information to bookmakers, which remains open. So if you think about politically England's relationships with India and Australia being so important, which all kind of comes down to, well, there's who do you go to?
Yeah.
Nasser Hussain was a name that got thrown around quite a lot, and rightly so, but I think he's happy with his media commitments.
It's a torrid time if you're an English cricket fan at the moment. Of course, we are very interested in this story because we are building up to an Ashes campaign in July and August. And
I'm going to barrack for the umpires.
You're going to barrack for the umpires. Well, you know, in sport, the umpires are never wrong. And they never change their mind. So you win all the time. 23 past 3, JP Howcroft with us on Halftime on a Wednesday afternoon. Back shortly. 27 past 3, JP Howcroft with us. Because the sneaky SMS machine, right, is having some issues... JP, we have got a very loyal listener from WA, Brendan from WA, who's decided that because there is a sneaky SMS issue, he's written an email.
Resourceful.
He's resourceful.
We like
initiative.
Yes.
I love it. He says, on KP, don't you just love it? It's like we're teasing England. The feisty Australian bullies just waiting to polish off the poor, innocent Poms. And we've got them worried about one of their best batsmen. Either way, we win and he doesn't play, they'll sook. We win and he plays, they'll sook. Either way, just make sure we play one of our best batsmen, Adam Voges, he says. After all, he hasn't given away trade secrets of his own team like KP. So a bit of feedback on what KP's done. But also some positivity towards WA's own, of course, Brendan. Adam Voges.
Yeah, I think he's well worth a place in the team. I mean, there's a question over whether there's a place available for him, but if he was selected, the weight of runs that he scored... this Sheffield Shield season, he's had a little stint in the county game, which has gone well. Thoroughly deserves a go.
He's going to the West Indies, isn't he? He and Farwad Ahmed are going as the most Yes. A high-scoring run batsman and then the highest wicket-taking bowler.
Yes.
Yes.
So by some distance as well.
Some margin.
You know, I think we talked about this a couple of months ago, didn't we? That you have to pick, you have to honour that kind of form. It's not just the difference between a guy averaging one or two more runs per innings. Mm. It was, you know, the margin was so significant that you have to honour it.
Can I take you to the part of the a continuation of the discussion now with regards to the Johnny Warren medal?
Yes.
We were talking about it with Matty Winley during the 1-2 hour from the Herald Sun birthday boy, Matty Winley, today. And he was outlining for me the procedure for the Johnny Warren medal. I wasn't aware of the voting system.
Yes.
Where at round 9, all the players in the A-League vote for their favourite player, the best player, and then they do it again at round 18, and then they do it again at round 27.
Yeah.
And then they collect those votes, and the winner is the winner. Nathan Burns was a worthy recipient of one of the finest players of the tournament.
Yes.
Of the competition.
Yes.
Was he, JP, I'll ask you this straight up, and then we'll talk about the assessment of the procedure. Was he the best player in the A-League for the year? You saw a lot of the games. Called a lot of the games. You were there on the sideline.
So I'm going to say no.
Good.
And then I'm going to say, because the definition of best is so nebulous, that there's the what is best. So for me, the best player I saw this season was Fahid Benkalfalah.
Yep.
The way he played, what he can do, what he did sometimes in games was better than anybody else that I saw. However, the most consistent player I saw all season was Aaron Moy. And on a week by week basis, if we had a cumulative Brownlow style voting, I would have given Aaron Moy 3 points. I would have given him some points in pretty much every game he played.
Yep.
But then I would have got to the end of the season and I would have thought, does a guy that finished mid-table for a team that didn't really do a lot deserve to be the player of the year? Shouldn't the player of the year be someone who is eye-catching and match-changing?
Is that more along the most valuable player category?
I guess it probably is. And Nathan Burns fits into that a lot more, particularly at the start of the season. He started the season like a train, played very, very well. But I think over the course of the season, it didn't sit as well with me. And Moy wasn't even in the shortlist.
Didn't make top five.
For the Johnny Warren medal.
No.
Which surprised me. And especially when you look at a couple of the names that were in there as well. Costa Barbarousis has been one. Yep. Who I didn't actually think had that strong a season, really, on a 27-game basis.
I wouldn't have thought he'd be top five.
Not
from what I saw, anyway.
Not for me. So, yeah, I mean, it really is just that question, throwing that question out there to the invisible, sneaky SMS machine. How do you do it? You know, we've got the system for the Brownlow, which every year there's the argument, and Matt Prittis is a perfect example about someone who is just... He just accumulated votes over a season.
Yep.
In a season in which Gary Ablett was standout for two-thirds of it, injured for the final third, and therefore rules himself out of contention. In this, I don't think there was a single standout that you could have just put your hat on and said, look, he's the best player. You've got Mark Yanko, scored a lot of goals, and you could easily gravitate towards him. Like I said, Fahid Benkalfalah, I think, caught the eye. So... Just really throwing it out there. And the another example that I'd use to bring in would be the Football Writers and Football Players Association Player of the Year in England, in the UK, was Eden Hazard from Chelsea.
Right.
Who fits the criteria of best player in best team. And again, it was a reasonably...
Is that consistent through that award?
Reasonably. It's a reasonably consistent pattern of train of thought that not always, but it was another year where there wasn't a standout individual. There was a lot of cases that you could be made for Harry Kane, polled well, John Terry polled well, but because there was no standout, the logic became, well, okay, who's had the most influence in the title race? So you kind of gravitate towards the best player in the best team, which this year was Hazard, but... Not that any wonderful footballer, but not that he's had such a good year that you'd have just gone, bang on, he's the best.
Well, throw it open to our listeners after the break, 9-4-2-9-11-16. What is the best way to come up with player of competition type awards? Who should it be thrown to? The referees, the media, the players? What sort of systems would you like to see in play? Or is it the Eden Hazard story, the best player in the best team? gets the nod as the player of the year. We'll take your calls after the break. 9:49, 11:16. Plenty more to talk about with JP. We'll do that on halftime. Jonathan Howcroft is with us on a Wednesday afternoon on halftime. The dual international. Gee, he was good. Such a fine, fine athlete during those days. Hey, JP, there's some fine, fine athletes involved this weekend in the Hyundai A-League. And Sunday, grand final with the Melbourne Victory hosting Sydney FC. You, last week, you came in here and you wanted to illuminate the audience on the intricacies of the game. And you did so beautifully. And what would be happening throughout the semi-final with yes. Melbourne Victory, Melbourne City particularly. Did a great job. And I'll go so far as to say, as you nailed your assessment of the game. Nailed it.
Yeah.
The wingers.
I got lucky.
No, you know. You didn't get lucky. You know stuff. This is why you're back here again this week. You probably would have been back anyway, but this is why you're back this week. You know stuff and you nailed it. Are you able to give the same type of picture of, paint the picture of what will happen on Sunday in similar terms?
I'll do my best. It's more difficult because they're much more evenly matched teams. So looking at it from a Sydney point of view, if you're watching the game thinking, okay, what am I looking at in terms of Sydney FC?
Yep.
They are a much bigger, a much stronger, much more aggressive team than Melbourne City. And they match up well against Melbourne Victory. The three or four key plays that you should really keep an eye out are their front three or four. So they've got Mark Janko as a centre forward. And yep. then just behind him, going across the pitch, you've got Bernie Beeney, Alex Brosk, and Chris Naumoff. Probably Chris Naumoff. Would presume that that's going to be their front three. They work incredibly hard. They press Melbourne Victory. They will press Melbourne Victory as high up the field as possible,
yep.
which will mean that Victory's defenders don't have much time on the ball when they're playing that first pass out of defence. So watch that closely. If it looks like Victory have got time on the ball, that's probably good for them. That probably okay. means that they've established a structure, created space, that has slightly beaten Graham Arnold's tactics. He will set up specifically for Melbourne Victory, whereas Kevin Muscat will probably just line up with his 4-2-1-3. It works. Brilliant. Best team in the competition so far. Back it again.
Yep.
From a Victory perspective...
Just on that, if you don't mind. It's interesting, different approach to the philosophy, your coaching philosophy, whereas... You're saying that Kevin Muscat's got this system that works.
Yes.
It's worked all season long. Why would I think about too much alteration to that? We're yep. not changing that now. Whereas Graham Arnold's thinking about, okay, this is what we can do. But what are they doing? And how far do we adjust
yes.
to temper their effectiveness?
Yeah. It's just I guess Graham Arnold is more of a pragmatist from a coaching viewpoint.
Yep.
So Kevin Muscat has, and rightly so, they top the ladder. They've got a home grand final. Everything is on their time. So back yourselves. Sydney, it's slightly different. That Graham Arnold is a more pragmatic coach, and his players are, I wouldn't say more adaptable, but the way he builds a squad creates really significant buy-in. So players are prepared to sacrifice a lot of what they might do attacking for what they can do defensively and fit the team structures. So. Bernie Beeney, for me, is their key player.
Yep.
He is such a wild card. He's compared to a lot of other promising young attackers in Australian football, I think he's got the highest ceiling. He's not consistent.
Really?
He will make a lot of mistakes, but his physical attributes and his direct nature is very, very hard to defend against. So it'd be interesting to see who Melbourne Victory pick at fullback as their two fullbacks, because you can easily see Bernie Beeney switching to the left flank, where Lee Broxham started at right back against Melbourne City, and I'm not keen on that matchup from a Victory viewpoint. For me, Victory's two key players are Carl Valeri and Mark Milligan. So whereas when we were looking at the Melbourne City game and saying this was
the wingers,
yes, and it was all about how they were going to attack, I think there's going to be goals in this game, full stop. It's about who controls the tempo, who owns the middle of the park, and for me that's about Carl Valeri and Mark Milligan, because what they're going to have to do defensively is cover their two fullbacks. Naumoff and Ibini is strong. Alex Brosk will find space like Guy Finkler does. They need to keep an eye on him as well. And because of the way Sydney press when they don't have the ball, that first pass out from the goalkeeper or the four defenders will be very pressured. That will mean that Milligan and Valeri have to find space.
Have to get back in and out.
Exactly. Just in front of the back four to try and find that space to receive that first pass and then distribute it further forward. So for me, if Milligan and Valeri play well, high hopes for Melbourne victory. And then the third point, more of a general game thing, it's a huge game for the referee.
Who we got? Strebre?
It's definitely not Strebre. I can guarantee you 100% it's not Strebre. I'm pretty sure it's Jared Gillette, but don't quote me on that. I don't know if it's been officially announced.
Right. Let's see if I can find that out.
But pretty sure it'll be Jared Gillette. If it is, he's not card shy, but he has had a good season. He was voted the referee of the year at the recent FFA awards.
Well, he's got to get it if he's the ref of the year.
And if you think about Victory Sydney FC games, they are fractious. They both have experienced players, both have plenty of players with short fuses. Coaches have got short fuses. You think back to the game in Sydney earlier this season when a dodgy penalty changed the game in Sydney's favour. Early grand finals historically have been decided late. There's been no shortage of red cards or penalties in these games. You just hope he keeps his head. You hope the players don't give him an excuse to alter the course of the game. But just for that, particularly that final 5 or 10 minutes, if the game is still in the balance, he could. I hope he isn't, but he could prove to be the decisive factor.
We don't want them referees being decisive factors in the game. JP.
Just everything about this game points towards the referee being a significant influence. Not so much in the semi-final. I wasn't overly concerned about that.
Yep.
In that instance, but this time I am. So have a look at him. See how he's travelling. If it looks like he's got control of the game, like he's got a good relationship with the players, he's talking to them well, that they're not backbiting every time he gives a decision, then that's a good sign. If not, it could be we might not finish with 11 players on each team.
Right, which is a bit of a setback if it goes into extra time and you've got to go the 120.
Exactly.
And you're short a player.
For sure. And then if it goes to penalties and you've had...
Is that player not eligible for the penalties?
No.
Should it go deep? What happens? Well, here you go. This is a question that I'd want to know the answer to. If they go through the loop of penalty, the whole roster with the penalties, gets to whatever it is, 13, 11, 11, 10, 10...
Yep.
What happens then?
You start again. Yeah. So whoever was your first penalty taker will take the 12th penalty.
Yeah.
If everybody's taking a kick.
Yeah. Oh, that'd be good fun.
It's great. Because, yeah. I mean, by that point, the goalkeeper's already taken their penalties. I mean, some goalkeepers can take, you know, Manuel Neuer, for example. He's a very confident penalty taker for Bayern Munich. But, yeah, it's good. It's good to watch keeper on keeper.
Half of me wants to see a penalty shootout, and half of me thinks it's still a crap way to finish a grand final.
It's not a good way, but it's a way, and you have to find a way, don't you?
You do find a way. That's all you have to do in the end of the grand final day. Just find a way. 12-4. Back with more JP after this. JP Howcroft, always good company on a Wednesday afternoon. Speaking of good company, what's Kevin Peterson tweeting?
So, 10 minutes ago, he tweeted, "Morning all." I wish you could do the accent. After a pretty bad day yesterday, I've given it a lot of thought overnight. I'm applying for the coaching job.
Hashtag
Strauss logic.
Nice.
That would be great, wouldn't it?
Wow, they are looking for a coach.
Imagine.
He'd be a good coach.
Imagine what kind of response they would give that application.
What would Colin give it? What would Colin and the ECB give it?
Oh, I don't think Colin is anti-KP. I think Colin
seems to be pro-KP from what we know of the situation.
It's Big Cheese Straussy.
Chief Straussy. Nice work from KP. Hey, JP, what's your take on the AFL system up until this point? AFL season, sorry, not system, up until this point.
Right. So here's my question.
This is
for me to throw out rather than for me to answer.
I like when you answer things. You say it so well.
Every week, it feels like this season, we're in a situation where every week anybody can beat anybody.
Yeah, it's good, isn't it?
I'm told repeatedly that this is what the grand plan of equalisation, a salary cap, a draft system is all about. Mm. Are you happy?
Am I happy?
Yes. Are you happy? Are the listeners happy? Is this, presumably, this is the panacea. This is the promised land.
Well, I'm not sure it's the promised land just yet.
Why?
But it's going a fair way to it.
Why isn't it the promised land just yet?
Well, because we are yet to see long term whether or not this is sustainable for these teams that are supposedly supposed to be minnows, the minnows for the season, and whether or not they can achieve anything throughout the season. If they are able to build hope and win games and develop, and in 2 years' time, 3 years' time, be a force in the competition, that's when we start to see.
Yeah.
That's the panacea. That's Andrew's favourite word, the panacea. That's when we start to think, this is actually going really well.
So my question then, my kind of supplementary question is, does it matter where the equalisation is within the competition? So, for example, if everybody was playing as well as Hawthorn, brilliant. You know, if the Hawthorn Grand Final 2014 standard was what everybody was playing at, then clearly we would have a very good competition.
That'd be great.
If we're all equalised down to St Kilda 2014, then maybe not.
No, that's crap.
But it's still equalisation,
yes.
If that's what you get.
We want quality equalisation. There's a caveat on the equalisation.
There you go, you see. So where do you think we are at the moment? Do you think we've got...
We're at Richmond. We're ninth.
So everyone's going to finish ninth. just percentage difference.
I think we're Richmond at the moment. We're not Hawthorn of 2014. We're not St Kilda of 2014. We may, in fact, be Richmond.
Right.
We're not sure where we fit in the grand scheme of things, but it's a really good contest. Is that fair?
I don't feel well placed to answer. My instinct is to agree with you, but it feels like we're kind of happy about some aspects of it, but we're not prepared to jump in with both feet.
No, we're not quite ready to go in with the suit on just yet.
Yeah,
But you know, I'll take the shirt off and I'll get the roll the pants up and get the knees wet. But that's about it. At this stage, happy about it.
Yeah.
Keen to get involved in those shenanigans, but not quite getting in fully clothed.
So the question, or the next stage then, is the responsibility of the teams at the bottom end who haven't joined in into this great free-for-all to book their ideas up.
I would like them to do that.
Yeah.
And quite promptly, if they don't mind, because they're dragging the whole thing down, and it's not cool. We'll take a break.